Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, what are you doing to dodge the personal tax raid? Lee looks at the ways people are avoiding Reeves's raid. Also today, we look at investing in video game brands as Nintendo Switch 2 launches. How much does a comfortable retirement really cost? Plus, more neighbourly disputes. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, how much more can we be taxed? That's apparently a common conversation that Lee's been having, well, rather a lot over the past few years with the people that he knows. And it's a conversation that's going on in the upper echelons of power in the UK as the government try to think how much more they can tax us. But we're hearing more and more of the wealthy are upping sticks and heading off to more tax-friendly climes. The middle class is too, fed up with frozen tax thresholds, rising council tax, eye-watering water bills, increasing train fares, the list goes on, might not be leaving the country, but they are changing their financial behaviour, according to Lee, who's been looking into this. Lee, what have you found?
Well, first of all, Georgie, I should quote the 1970s film Network, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And I feel that that's how a lot of people in Britain are feeling about the amount of tax that they're currently paying, especially those who I would deem kind of middle class, you know, hardworking people who, you know, believe in this country, love this country, but are getting to a kind of boiling point when it comes to, you know, all of the things that you just mentioned. So more tax and more bills that are completely unavoidable that are going up. And we've had this conversation, of course, on the podcast many times, but it is a conversation that I'm having more and more with people. So things like council tax, as you say, you know, it's just blindly going up every year. Water bills, some of the hikes this year have been absolute monstrous. We need water. You need water in your house. You can't dodge that. So there's a lot of things that are going on. And it looks like there could be more pain on the way. You know, you only have to read the headlines. This week, we're saying basically that we spend 2.37% of GDP on armed forces, and NATO are expected to demand that to be 5%. That's probably going to mean more tax hikes on the way to plug that. It goes on and on and on. And actually, this week, there was a Treasury Select Committee, and it quizzed officials from HMRC. And in the blurb beforehand, it said, it has been widely reported tax changes implemented during the Chancellor's 2024 autumn budget have led to behavioural changes, including an increase in money gifted to family members. I thought that was quite a strong statement to put out in the blurb of this before this Treasury Select Committee was out, and suggest that in under 12 months, people are wising up to the fact, the big one, that pensions are going to be included in inheritance tax calculations from 2027. And I think that that is playing a lot on people's minds, especially those who have diligently saved for their retirement and are now panicked into wondering how much is going to get taken away potentially for their descendants. Hence, people are behaving differently. So I picked out four things in this column that I'd written this week. And the first one, I don't think is going to come to a surprise to anyone, especially if you have been listening carefully to the podcast this year. I said a couple of times that I felt that moving the goalpost of ISAs, which has been in the crosshairs of the Chancellor, saying that although the £20,000 annual limit looks likely to remain, there are question marks over whether or not the cash ISA element would be reduced. And the figure that's been regularly quoted is £4,000. And the idea would be that people basically couldn't just use their tax-free accounts to put it into, you know, bog-standard savings accounts, and instead would have to invest if they wanted to utilise the rest of the allowance. Now, we haven't had any confirmation of this, but there is a lot of rumours still going around about it. And I kept on thinking, and I said it a couple of times on this podcast, that I felt like it was going to create a massive behavioural change. People would see the 2025, 26 tax year as the last time they could completely stuff their ISAs full of cash. Because if it got cut to £4,000, of course, it would take 5 years to ever have that allowance ever again at £20,000 for cash. So lo and behold, we had some figures from the Bank of England. £14 billion went into cash ISAs in April, a record month by some distance. And it's likely that a big chunk of that has been diverted away from stocks and shares, which is, of course, the very product that Rachel Reeves is looking for Britons to turn to. So that's behavioural change number one. Behavioural change number two, I think lots of people are looking at how to sidestep future inheritance tax bills. Now, I think that, you know, lots of savvy people do this anyway, but there are a lot of people that reach a certain age and they find it a too morbid thought to future plan ahead, or they've left it too late. They find it too complicated. And, you know, it's a kind of, it's almost, it's not my problem type thing. But there are a lot of people, I believe, that are wising up massively to the inheritance tax thing that is coming down the line. We always quote this figure, don't we, that it affects about 4% of estates. It's likely to affect more like 10% of estates when pensions are put into this from 2027. I would have thought that in the 2030s that could rise possibly even further, because lots of people have been encouraged to save into their private pensions, make sure they've got enough for retirement, make sure they're not relying on whatever the state pension is going to look like from the 2030s, 40s, 50s and beyond, are going to be the ones that are, of course, going to be probably hit by this. So I think the things that people are kind of quite clear on is the maximum tax-free gift of £3,000 to children, grandchildren, relatives, and then going above that to try and benefit from the seven-year rule of giving more away. And of course, that seven-year rule, there was rumours around that being extended to 10 years not so long ago. So these goalposts, of course, can move. But I think one thing that's clearly gaining a lot of traction, especially when we look at what our readers are doing, what they're reading, what they're clicking on, what they're commenting on, is about gifting surplus income. And we had a story this week about a 59-year-old who is gifting out surplus income from his SIP to his two daughters, giving them a monthly income and basically trying to sidestep inheritance tax this way. You have to make sure you keep very good records. I mean, you have to sort of demonstrate that it's not impacting your everyday life. You know, you're not going without because you're gifting your money away. But well worth getting yourself completely abreast of what these rules are and how to utilize them potentially for your family. We did a story and we talked about it on the podcast a little while back about if you potentially could fall into this inheritance tax trap. And we laid out the four different family scenarios. I'm sure if you're a regular listener to the podcast, you'll remember it. Now, I went into that story and I was reading the comments in there. The amount of people that said that they were emptying their pension into an ISA was pretty interesting. You know, it's suggesting, again, another way that people are changing their behavior, because you probably would never have even crossed your mind. It wouldn't have been something that you potentially would have done. I'm not going to go into all the ins and outs of what that entails and what it involves, but we did have Ian Cook, who's a chartered financial planner at Quilter, warning that emptying a pension into an ISA in order to try and dodge inheritance tax could epically backfire. So you have to kind of make sure you know what you're doing. Speak to a financial advisor if you're in that really wealthy cohort of people. But it shows that people are potentially rushing into decisions because of all the fears and the rumors and you know, everything that has happened since Rachel Reeves has become Chancellor. And lastly, earning £100,000 as an annual salary has almost become a burden. Rather than become something to be potentially proud of or to potentially aspire to. Exactly. And Simon's obviously spoken about this a lot, and I don't want to kind of bang the drum too much, but ticking over that between £100,000 and £125,140 annual salary ticks you into this 60% income tax rate, which effectively has been around since 2009 and no one has gone to fix. But the other thing to point out here, that when you tip over £100,000, if you're a couple and you've got a young family, there's been an enhanced childcare program that has come out for people around wraparound care and around nursery places. Nurseries are incredibly expensive now. And this, if you earn over £100,000, you can't take advantage of that, whether that's one of you in the couple or both of you. But I should point out here, not combined. It's just if one of you earns more than £100,000. But you could potentially, the savings on offer from that are roughly £8,000 a year. I mean, that's pretty sizable. And I just think what it does is putting these barriers up to earning that kind of money. Yes, it's a dilemma. And of course, it's a good dilemma to have, that you're successful in a career and you're earning a six-figure salary. Lovely. You know, you must be good at what you do and you must be working hard and, you know, you should be proud of yourself. But it got to the point where almost earning between those two amounts of money is a kind of, you have to crunch the numbers to make sure it's worth it. And I think that there's a kind of generation of people going, it's not worth the stress, it's not worth the hassle, it's not worth kind of pushing myself up the ladder and pushing myself to the limit just to have such a huge tax burden. And I think they're the four things that I've picked on in this column, and I'm sure that there's other things. And I'm going to be fair here and say that I think in my mind, the tax rot really began with the Conservatives freezing those thresholds for income tax. I think it was a really unconservative thing to do. And again, we've spoken about that for a number of years. The 40% tax ban, £50,720, is dragging millions and millions of more workers into it, where it's becoming the norm rather than, you know, not being the norm. And it's hard for the government to wean themselves off of the money that this is generating. But the 40% tax ban, if it had risen with inflation, should be more like £75,000, which is probably, I would argue, the more correct level. But it would take a very brave chancellor to start mucking around with all of those now. And, you know, Rachel Reeves can rightly point out, well, this was a Conservative measure. So it's not, I can't imagine she's just going to turn it around and go, you know, we're going to start raising, unfreezing these bans. And I think that, again, I'm sure there's lots of listeners and you guys that know this, but if you only have to have a look around social media at the moment, there's just a massive flurry of people talking about moving to more tax-friendly countries like Dubai and to Portugal, rightly or wrongly, you know, bemoaning the cost of Britain and, you know, kind of fed up with it. The Chancellor's obviously added all of her own special ingredients into the mix on top of those frozen thresholds and the other things that Conservatives have done, such as national insurance hikes for employers, farm inheritance tax changes, culling the winter fuel allowance, which has just felt like a massive own goal. And now they're scrambling away, talking this week about ways to basically make sure that people get the winter fuel allowance. And then it seems like the most popular way to do it is to start paying it to everyone again, but then clawing it back in tax. I mean, it's an epic mess. And I think that I would say most of our listeners are probably, you know, aspirational people, and it's all piling on top of us aspirational people. And we're going, what's the point? Fed up of it.
Quite. Simon, there's so much I want to talk to you about. Specifically, we have a reader question about the £100,000 60% tax burden. But before we get there, do you sense that people's financial habits have changed in response to, well, as Lee said, it's not just the sort of tax rises with Labour, but I suppose that is what people sort of are thinking about at the moment, especially with thoughts that perhaps there'll be further tax rises coming in the budget as well.
I do agree. I think it's distorting people's behaviour, and I think it's making people do things they wouldn't otherwise do. Now, you could argue that potentially some of those things, maybe there's a cunning plan, you know, encouraging people who are sitting on large pension pots that they were just going to pass on at death. And bear in mind that that is a very, very small number of people. This is one of those things that's talked about far more than is actually happening. Most people do not have spare pension pots that they're sitting on to pass on at death. But there is a chunk of society who do. Encouraging those people to start giving away those pensions earlier arguably is a good thing. It encourages growth. And in fact, the biggest mistake that the government could possibly make would be to extend the 7-year rule to 10 years rather than cutting the seven-year rule. If you cut the seven-year rule, you'll increase the number of people who actually try to give away money early. Now, you might lose some money to tax at the back end of that, but that money being given, for example, you know, to adult children, to grandchildren and so on, to go into house deposits, to go into first-time buyers, moving home, helping them out with stuff financially, that all boosts economic growth. So maybe there's a wider plan here. I'm not so sure there is. I think it's just a tax grab. But maybe there's a wider plan. But I mean, regular listeners to the podcast will know that I am not a fan of Britain's tax system. It is an unholy mess where mistake upon mistake has compounded over the years. And I would trace it all the way back to the financial crisis, actually, where some decisions were made. And then, unfortunately, through the coalition government and then through the Tory government, there was this concern of doing anything that might be seen to be favouring rich people, even though that was at the expense of having a badly structured tax. The 60% tax trap that we're going to talk about in a bit, the child benefit removal tax trap, stamp duty, inheritance tax even. You know, the Tories actually really wanted to, like, potentially just get rid of it. But instead, we've made mistake after mistake, or we've kicked the can down the road and we've compounded the errors. And I think it has changed people's behaviour. And I don't think that it's changed people's behaviour overall for the best. I think it's led to people making rash decisions or doing what they say in the industry of letting the tax tail wag the dog. Basically, what that means is don't base your decisions on, like, you're just trying to avoid some tax. You know, there's sensible ones like that, i.e. should I put my money in a cash ISA or a taxed savings account? That's a sensible tax avoiding decision. Should I pull all of my money out of my pension in terms of my tax-free lump sum ahead of the budget because I'm worried that they're going to cut the tax-free lump sum, but I don't know whether they're going to? That's a bad decision. Okay. So, you know, you could go between those two things. But it's not just me moaning about this, right? And to be clear, I blame the Tories. I also blame the Labour Party because Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer had a clear opportunity to change direction. Everybody knows we've got a problem, and instead they've made it even worse. The £22 billion black hole stuff, you know, the budget, the so on, the promise not to raise certain taxes. But Andy Haldane, former chief economist of the Bank of England, had a pretty damning verdict on it this week. He said, there's been mistakes, rookie errors. The black hole announcement sucked the confidence from business and consumers. The budget compounded that felony. It's not been the sort of thing we need to get the animal spirits in the country going and therefore the country growing, right? That's not me saying that. Obviously, I agree with him because what he's saying agrees with what I think. Now, there'd be lots of people listening to the podcast who don't agree with me, but I do think that we do need a change of direction. And I think the problem we've got is that there's this promise that's been made not to raise income tax, national insurance, or VAT. Actually, as a country, what you want is to be getting your income from your main taxes, okay? So you want to be getting it from income taxes, which is what income tax and national insurance are, from VAT, right? That's a common tax around the world. Every country has some form of VAT. And then from some form of property tax, local property tax usually, which we have in the form of council tax. Unfortunately, every single one of these, like, we have a bit of a problem with. Firstly, we said we're not going to raise the three big ones. So out of those, income tax raises 28% of tax receipts, national insurance raises 18%, and VAT raises 17%. Two-thirds of all of our tax income, okay? The other major tax in there we've got is business rates and council tax. Business rates and council tax are a right mess, right? Because business rates are causing small businesses all kinds of problems. Council tax is completely bonkers. It's all collected locally, then it goes centrally, then it's distributed back to councils according to a formula. But the reason why councils don't have enough money to spend on everything that they're meant to be doing is because of every £1 of council tax that they spend, more than half of it is going into adult social care and children's social care. So the government's not picking up the tab. It's forcing the councils to pick up the tab, which is why they don't have enough money to do the things that we want them to do, like fix the roads. And we've ended up with a scenario where, because we've said we won't raise income tax, national insurance, or VAT, we're having to do this tinkering around the edges, which I described the other week as like a budget airline tax system, right? So realistically, what you want your airline to be doing is making most of its money from selling you an airfare. And then it lets you take a bag and have a seat and all those other things that you would normally expect from an airline. Now, obviously, that got turned on its head. And the model is now flog people the seat for as little money as possible and then charge them as much as possible for everything else. Where can you catch them out? That's what we've done with our tax system. Instead of having a simple income tax system, we have done the catch people out thing. And what we're doing is we've also compounded that by saying we're not going to raise the main taxes. We're just going to try to raise the ones that catch people out. And the problem with that is that because those ones raise much less money than the other big ones that we've said we won't change, we have to like do even more crazy things to try and catch people out to raise money. And this is totally insane. And the problem, as you alluded to, and as Jeff wrote in his column this week, is it doesn't look like it's going to get any better because we've painted ourselves into a corner with these fiscal rules that, as we talked about after the budget, are complete nonsense. We're basically trying to tick some boxes in a spreadsheet and then something comes along a week later, Trump's tariffs, totally upends things. Trump's tariffs have now changed 2 months later. Has it upended things back? Are we back where we started? Who knows? Our debt costs have gone up. We're going to get to the budget. Rachel Reeves is going to need to meet her own fiscal rule that she made up again, and we're going to get some more tinkering at more budget airline taxes because we can't raise the main rates of tax. Now, arguably, what she should have done instead of raising national insurance on employers is put the national insurance rate for employees back up. The Tories cut that twice. I'm not sure we could afford the first one. We definitely couldn't afford the second one. We should have just reversed that. Would have been a good move. The other thing that really probably needs to happen is we need to sort out the income tax mess. But it's not going to happen. And it's probably just going to get worse, unfortunately.
I did say, Simon, that we'd answer this reader question. I've had a big pay rise to $125,000. Should I salary sacrifice as much as possible into my pension? Of course, this is all about the 60% tax rate after £100,000. Just really basically explain what that is. And what's the answer to this?
Well, this question came in the same week that NatWest, the bank formerly known as RBS, finally fully exited taxpayer ownership. Now, those two things may not seem directly related, but they are, because Britain's stake in RBS came about due to the financial crisis and us having to rescue the bank. At that point, we introduced some emergency tax measures. One, thanks to Alistair Darling, was the removal of the personal allowance at a rate of £1 for every £2 earned above £100,000. And what this does is it effectively adds 50% to the tax rate. So officially, the tax rate for somebody in that position is 40%. But because they're losing £1 for every £2 earned from their personal allowance, which you can also think of, the easy way to understand this is 50p for every extra pound earned. That helps you understand the why it bumps up by 50%. It actually bumps up the marginal rate to 60%. So people pay a 60% tax rate until they've lost their entire personal allowance. Currently, that is between £100,000 and just over £125,000, at which point they've totally lost their personal allowance and their marginal tax rate goes back to the actual official tax rate, which now is 45p. The scenario that this creates is that if you got a £20,000 pay rise from £100,000, okay, or £105,000 to £125,000, you would only see £8,000 of that money because you would lose 60% of it to tax. Now, I think that's pretty bad. I don't think there should be a 60% tax rate at any level. I don't think that anybody should. I don't think that as a principle in the tax system, you should end up with less money than the tax man. So I don't agree with any tax rate above 50%. Okay, I think 45%, the top tax rate we've got, is about as high as you should go, especially as you have to add 2% national insurance on top of that. So it's really 47%. Okay, you certainly shouldn't be losing 60%. What I think compounds the issue as well is if that £100,000 threshold had moved up in line with RPI inflation, which, let's remember, CPI might be the official one, but RPI is the one that the government likes to use when it's taking money off people. It would now be at £180,000. That's, I mean, a big difference, right? And that just shows what happens if you leave something frozen for, what are we on, 2009, 2025, 16 years? Yeah, I mean, you know, it compounds. Anyway, the only real way to beat this is to get your income down. So going back to my point about totally bonkers tax system, we basically have a cottage industry in this country of people trying to earn less money due to like weird bits of the tax system. In my mind, that's not a good idea, particularly as some of the people trying to earn less money, child benefit removal, you know, £60,000, 60% tax rate, £100,000, and so on, are arguably some of the most productive people in you know, the country. And also, we tax those people quite a lot of money. So it's in our best interest not for them to be trying to artificially get their income down. Salary sacrifice is one way of doing this. Salary sacrifice is basically very beneficial to people because what you do is you give up some of your earnings and then your employer does something with that money for you. The most common use of this is pension schemes. So we have a salary sacrifice pension scheme at work. And instead of us making a contribution from our post-tax earnings and then having it bumped up by tax relief and then having to claim the extra tax relief if you're a higher rate taxpayer, they just take it out of your earnings, pay it straight into your pension, and your employer pays into it as well. The benefit for this, you know, is to employees that you also save on the national insurance, which is more beneficial to lower earners than higher earners because, you know, they're paying that higher rate of national insurance, but also there's a benefit to the employers because they save on national insurance for employers as well. You can also use salary sacrifice to do other things, but in most cases, the benefit is clawed back, apart from a couple of things that are seen as good things. So you used to be able to use it for childcare vouchers. Most people can't do that anymore. You can use it for employer nurseries, interestingly. You can use it for cycle to work schemes. And you can also use it for buying an electric car through like a company lease scheme in which there is a benefit in kind tax, which is the way they claw back some of the money, but it's very, very small. Now, there's talk that the Treasury is eyeing up salary sacrifice as a way of basically getting a bit more money back. And I think we talked about this in more detail on last week's podcast. But what it means is for somebody in this position, hence the question, they're asking, should I salary sacrifice as much as possible of my pay rise, of my salary, into my pension now? So it's like front loading it. Obviously, they're going to get their 20,000 pay rise spread over the next 12 months, over 12 months of their earnings. But they've said, basically, I could probably afford to just use some of my savings to live on and shove as much of this into my pension as possible because I'm worried they're going to cut back on salary sacrifice in the budget and then I'll lose the whole thing. Okay. Now, in theory, yes, you could do that. In practice, you need to think about it very carefully. Again, don't let the tax tail wag the dog and so on. Can you genuinely do this? I mean, obviously you have to check that your employer is okay with it, but they've said their employer is. But arguably, if you were somebody in this very rare position and very fortunate position, let's remember they've had a big pay rise and they earn a six-figure salary, then, you know, it would be financially beneficial to you. And I think this is a question and an answer that just magically illustrates the madness of the tax system.
Wouldn't it be easier just to, and look, I'm no advocate for upping how much income tax people pay, but wouldn't it be better just to get rid of that tapering off of the sort of personal allowance and just raising the rate of income tax just by 1 or 2p? Didn't the IFS say the best way to really actually raise tax would be to increase the basic rate by 1p? But no one's going to do that. But it just might be a softener to this ridiculous system that, like you say, is disincentivizing people to want to earn more, to have that entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, it's a ludicrous system. And the point of tax is it's sort of meant to be fair.
Yeah, and interestingly, the tone of the comments and the sentiment in them has changed on our stories about 60% tax trap over the last couple of years. And it always used to be, well, sod them, they're rich. And there's quite, and there's still like a fair amount of that, but there's a lot more, this is just completely unfair. Coming from people who were saying, look, I don't earn this, but this is completely unfair. You can't be taking 60% off people. This is not a fair way to treat people.
Which is the same as inheritance tax argument when not a lot of people pay it, but you just hate the principle of it.
And going back to Lee's people's behavior changing thing, what's interesting is that all of this stuff changes people's behavior who aren't necessarily actually at risk from it. And it's because it creates a perception, which is what I think, you know, going back to what Andy Haldane said and my view that we need to totally overhaul our tax system. I think we could actually deliver growth by totally overhauling our tax system and get more tax in. It is that it's the sentiment that it creates, the negative sentiment. And you are right. Paul Johnson of the IFS has pointed out repeatedly that it's only people above a certain income who are paying more tax and having a greater tax burden on them. The tax burden, what's described as the tax burden, you know, the rate of tax that we're taking in from people is the highest it's been, you know, since just after the Second World War. But actually, if you look at it, and we did an article on this last summer, it's falling on higher earners, not lower earners. The tax rate paid by lower earners has fell through the Tory years. They substantially reduced that. And arguably that is a good thing to be doing. But we've come to the point where we're too reliant on catching out higher earners and not reliant enough on getting the bulk of the population to pay the taxes that we need to deliver the public services that people say they want. And if we want the level of public services that we do want, if we need to pay the pensions that we want to pay, if we want to fund the NHS in the way that we want to fund the NHS rather than going towards a kind of public stroke private system, then we do need to raise the basic rate of income tax. And if we, you know, putting that up by a penny or 2p is arguably the better move, but that's a very difficult sell for any government, and it's a really difficult sell for a Labour government that's already being criticised for cutting spending. And it goes back to that point where politicians are absolutely terrified of doing anything that would be seen to be benefiting rich people, even though they know that fundamentally, as a whole, it would be the right thing to do to sort out the tax system.
Right, we're going to leave this to one side because I have no doubt we will return to this again and again, especially coming up to the budget. But the gaming industry, not something we talk about too often here, but it is bigger than ever before, and it's expected to reach $236.9 billion this year and just over $280 billion by 2031. That's according to Media Research. Now, Nintendo, which launched its Switch 2 this week to queues of fans outside tech stores, has seen its share price rise by 32% in the past year. Over the past 5 years, the firm is up 151%. So are gaming brands a good investment? Before we get to that, Lee, when we're talking about this, we don't mean the equipment, do we? Because I always think of you in your sort of glass cabinet with your old Nintendos. And can you also, I'm really sorry, I'm going to sound really old now. Actually, it's probably not old. It's probably just I don't care about gaming. What is a Switch 2?
A Switch 2. So it's the next one in the line of the Switch series. Nintendo Switch came out in 2020. It's been wildly popular. The reason why I think it came out before 2020, thinking about it. But the reason why it's so popular is the USP of it is that you can use it on the go, but you can also then turn it into a console at home and carry on, you know, your saved game data, basically. And the other thing that's very popular about it is it appeals to children and adults alike because you've got the aspects of the social online gaming stuff. But the games tend to be a little bit more family friendly than, say, some of the more kind of meaty titles like your Grand Theft Autos, etc., that you get on PlayStation and Xbox. And yeah, it's just very popular, and people have been waiting for the Switch 2. It's fundamentally very similar, but just a better processor and obviously a new launch of games will, you know, get people excited. Now, the reason why I'm going to stick with Nintendo for a second, actually, I should point out, as you say, my glass cabinet of Nintendos, my 6-year-old is very much into the GameCube at the moment, the Nintendo GameCube, which came out early 2000s, and we're currently battling our way through completing Mario Kart Double Dash and Mario Sunshine, which were the two big Mario titles on that. She loves the GameCube. She loves it more than the Switch. Now, what's happening in the gaming industry as a whole is, well, first of all, the Switch 2 launch, the price of games have been inching up because the cost of development has become, you know, higher, and people's expectations are higher. And actually, the base price for the new Mario Kart that's launched with Switch 2 is £67, which might make you go, "Whoa, how much?" But £67, you know, for a game that people will play a lot of hours, and that's where you have to look at these things. I think you have to see the sort of hour per kind of cost. And it keeps you insane for a very long time. Now, the reason, you know, for example, Nintendo's doing very well with the share price that you pointed out there, is the, you know, selling the hardware, so the console, you know, but the stuff that goes alongside it, including the games, are, you know, making the money, but especially the more reoccurring kind of membership elements of stuff. So if you want to play Nintendo Switch Online, for example, with all of its content, which is like expansion packs, and one of the big things that the Nintendo Switch 2 has got on it is preloaded GameCube games, believe it or not. And that costs you £35 a year. And people will just pay that every year. So that's a reoccurring income, which they would never have had from old consoles, because you'd buy a console and you'd buy games for it. And then that was that. You know, you wouldn't have this reoccurring payment. So that is doing very well for them. The other thing that a lot of the gaming industry is kind of branching out to is stuff like films.
Minecraft.
Well, the Minecraft film, obviously, yeah. And I recently watched Gran Turismo, which was a PlayStation game back in the day, very, very in-depth car racing game. And part of the production of the film, obviously Sony and PlayStation were plugged quite hard in the film because it's their IP. So they're making quite a lot of money from these kind of things. So what we've got here is eToro have done us a basket of leading game brands and how their share price has performed. I'll stick with the 5-year numbers because obviously investing for the long term. So Nintendo, as you say, returns 151%. Sony, 171%. Obviously PlayStation and the games that they have alongside that. Other companies that you might not even realize are listed, Capcom, for example, they're up 338%. People will probably be familiar with Capcom because of Street Fighter and Resident Evil. Electronic Arts up 26%, Take-Two 69%, Roblox 17%, and Konami's up 438%. The big loser actually in the last five years has been Ubisoft. A big part of that, they're the Call of Duty maker. And it's been a while since, you know, that franchise is kind of, I would argue, is probably not as popular as what it was once was. But it's quite interesting because, you know, they are some very big risers. Mm. And we're obviously, you know, the Gen Z generation are way bigger gamers than the millennial generation, who are, of course, way bigger game players than the generation above that. And it's just an industry that seems to be kind of growing and growing. And with all of these kind of other branches that these you know, companies are getting into, including the films and the reoccurring subscriptions, Sam North of eToro kind of saying, you know, that it's definitely having a worth a look in this sector. You know, he said here, increasing in reoccurring revenue models have helped to stabilize growth and is enabling publishers to generate predictable cash flows while reducing dependence on hit releases. And that's, you know, fundamentally now where the business has gone for a lot of these video game firms.
Yeah, Simon, it's one of those things I say I don't know a lot about, but it is huge. And it is competing. The things that I am interested in, like sport, is competing with this, isn't it? What do you make of the gaming industry as an investment, as speaking to experts in the field?
I think it's a very interesting industry. And I know some people who've worked in it in the past. And there's a lot of ideas that have transferred out of it, actually, you know, into the mainstream, some of that stuff around the whole in-game purchases and things like that. And I think what's interesting about the gaming industry is it's transitioned from a scenario where, like the music industry, really, they made most of their money from people buying albums in the music industry. The gaming industry made most of its money from people buying games. It's like you bought a game, sticker price of the game. And actually, whilst those prices that Lee quotes for the games sound pretty expensive, I'm pretty sure that if you took the price of the computer games, the console games that I was buying as a, you know, young teenager, as a 13-year-old, and then plugged them into our inflation calculator, you'd discover that computer game prices have gone up by way less than inflation. What they've had to do, though, is manage this transition to a world where people expect stuff for free. So, you know, people can get loads of games for free on their phone. And there's a whole gaming industry built around app stores and giving people games for free and then selling them these in-app purchases or moving them up the ladder, doing stuff with your most loyal customers, shifting into, you know, spin-off movies. And spin-off movies have been around for ages, haven't they? I mean, Tomb Raider. When did Tomb Raider come out? You know, that was Angelina Jolie, wasn't it? That was her like big kind of breakthrough thing. But I think it's really interesting. I think what people have to be careful of is, you know, chucking all your eggs in one basket, as with anything. You know, if you invest an outsized amount of your portfolio into a games maker or into a Nintendo or something, you could do very, very well when the shares go up. But those shares also have a tendency to go down quite sharply as well. So you need to think about how it fits into a broader, you know, investment portfolio if you're picking shares. Or maybe you look at, you know, choosing a fund or an investment trust or something that, you know, goes into one of those kind of, that invests in some of those games makers. The other thing that's interesting actually on this note is there is a British company which is not a computer game maker, but that has been doing exceptionally well recently, and that's Games Workshop. And that is also now about to benefit from the whole film spin-off effect or TV series spin-off effect with a deal that it struck with Amazon.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Alex Webbone of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Alex, a fairly straightforward question, I hope. What does the pension annual allowance include? Is it only money I pay in, or my employer's contributions too?
Hi, Simon. So the annual allowance for the 2025-26 tax year is £60,000, and it includes all contributions made to your pension within the tax year. So specifically, that means your personal contributions, your employer's contributions, any third-party contributions, for example, from a family member, and also the basic rate tax relief added by HMRC. So yes, your employer's contributions do count towards your annual allowance. If your total contributions exceed the annual allowance, you may be liable to pay a tax charge on the excess. However, there is a way around it, which is called carry forward, which is using the unused allowance from previous three tax years, assuming you were a member of the scheme during those years. Lastly, for defined benefit schemes, the input amount is based on the increase in the value of your benefits over the year, not the actual contributions. But these schemes can be a bit more complicated, so if you do have a concern around it, it's probably worth speaking to a specialist.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Our favourite retirement prediction figures came out this week, but they didn't make for the happiest of reading. The Pension and Lifetime Savings Association reckon you need over £60,000 a year for a couple and £43,900 if you're single for a comfortable retirement. Now, why we like this report is because the PLSA actually spell out what a comfortable retirement actually means. So, for example, they say a fortnight four-star holiday in the Med and three long weekend breaks in the UK would be moderate compared to just a week-long holiday in the UK every year with a minimum retirement. Now, what really did it for me, Simon, was years ago when this first came out, and they said for a minimum, it's four cans of Carling, whereas for a comfortable, it was a couple of bottles of, I don't know, Sauvignon. And I thought, if four cans of Carling isn't a reason enough to stick some money in your pension, I don't know what is. So anyway, what was in it, Simon?
Right, it's the PLSA figures, the one we've all been waiting for, a bit later this year than normal. Now, the good news is that actually the cost of a minimum retirement has gone down slightly. The bad news is the cost of a moderate or a comfortable retirement has gone up, but it's not gone up by as much as it has in the past or last year, for example, when there was a big jump, inflation, obvs. So I guess let's take the middle ground, a moderate retirement. Now, a moderate retirement, I'd take that as your standard retirement. Now, most of us will aspire to a comfortable retirement, obviously. But I think what those of us who are financially savvy would try to do is go, I'll aim for moderate and then I'll bolt on my own bits of comfortable, for example. Do I need a three-year-old small car replaced every 5 years? Nah, I don't need to do that. I can just keep the same car. And I don't need to spend all the money on the, you know, paying the dealership or doing my PCP or whatever. Do I need a fortnight's four-star holiday in the Med? well, there'd be lots of people who'd like a fortnight's four-star holiday in the Med. But maybe you could save some money by booking a villa yourself, you know, going at a cheaper time. You could definitely save money on your holidays. Three long weekend breaks in the UK. You might be able to save money on three long weekend breaks in the UK by taking three long weekend breaks in another country. You might actually be able to save money in your comfortable retirement by having a holiday in a foreign country rather than a week-long holiday in the UK, which, whenever I check it out, always seems to be much more expensive than just going to France. You might not need to spend £1,548 a year, a very precise sum, on clothing and footwear. Get yourself on Vinted, save a bit of money, and so on. But anyway, I think it's really interesting, but it does illustrate, actually, you know, it's quite expensive. So for a couple, moderate, £43,900 a year, comfortable, £60,600 a year. Now, this is for a couple, and they benefit from a very small version of an economy of scale. Two of you is cheaper than one of you times two, because, you know, you're sharing costs, you're sharing grocery costs, you're sharing housing costs, you're sharing all these other things. Now, actually, I should point out, this does not include housing costs or tax. So you will...
I was going to say, do they assume that you've already bought a house in this one?
They assume that you are a homeowner, yeah, and that you've paid off your mortgage. Now, if you are not and you're paying rent, then obviously that your cost is going to be considerably more expensive. And they also, it's post-tax. Now, you don't need to be a genius to work out that if you have got a retirement that's costing you £60,600 a year between two people, which is, you know, £30,300 each, that you are going to be paying some tax. So you're going to need to have more coming in. So actually, broadly speaking, you'd probably need, you know, at least £40,000 a year coming in each. And the difficulty is that when you magnify this stuff up and go, okay, what's the pot that I need to do this? Well, actually, firstly, let's break this down, right? So let's go for the couple, comfortable, £60,600 a year. State pension per person, £12,000 each, right? So that's picking up £24,000 of the tab. So then the pot income pre-tax per person that you would need is 22,758. And then the approximate fund size required per person, if you were purchasing an annuity to deliver this, is between £300,000 and £460,000. So basically, between the two of you, even including your state pension, you're going to need just under £1 million in your pension pot. That's a lot. And it would have inheritance tax implications, as we discussed earlier. So there you go. But, you know, most people probably won't buy an annuity. Actually, what they will do is they'll keep their pension invested and take money from it. And they might find also that obviously their costs are slightly higher in the earlier years of retirement than in the later years of retirement. This is not true for everyone. But, you know, there is a scenario where for people in their mid-60s into their 70s, that's the time when they might want to be taking those holidays, you know, going to the theatre, going out for dinner more. And then once people start to move into their 80s, they tend to spend less money. They tend to want to go on less holidays and do less of those things. The risk at the other end is care costs. If you have to go into long-term care, and that bill can very, very quickly mount up.
It can indeed. Lee, how close are we, I suppose, as a nation, to getting that comfortable retirement? I mean, I'm predicting you're going to say we're by and large well off.
We're by and large way off the figures that are required for this comfortable retirement. But I do think that we are in a kind of era and a generation in which we are more in control of our private pensions than ever before. Of course, generations above, not everyone, but gold-plated pensions obviously kind of set people up for life. I think reports like this are useful as a barometer, but I wouldn't take the figures as completely and utterly... It depends on your circumstances, but it's a good way of sharpening your mind and getting a target and a goal of how much you might need to have the kind of lifestyle you want. But you could argue that you get into retirement and you won't need anywhere near as much as what's been in this report, depending on what you're up to, because lots of things in life for free that people enjoy. I always find it interesting as a kind of bellwether of and barometer of what you need for your retirement. And if you're in your 50s and 60s, potentially this kind of report might make you panic a bit, because you might be, there'll be people that are hitting this target easy, but there might be some that feel well off of this. And then you've got the people sort of in their 30s and 40s going, that actually might make me just save an extra 1% of my salary each month to go into my pension. But yeah, by and large, a lot of people are way off both the moderate and comfortable sums in this report.
Any tips for us, Lee?
Save that extra 1% into your pension if you can. Yeah, I think my biggest tip of advice would be just, you know, whatever your age, don't bury your head in the sand. To go and have a look at where your retirement pot is now. It usually doesn't take long to log in and see where you're at. And a lot of the pension providers, you know, via your work, will give you forward predictions on how much they reckon you might have if you continue saving at the same rate that you're currently saving, and will quite often tell you the effect if you put in an extra percent or an extra 2%, for example. So I would definitely just go and have a look. And you've got to look after number one, Georgie. You've got to make sure that you are, you know, on top of all of this and not just blindly expecting in decades' time for the state pension to be in the same state it currently is, for, you know, someone else is going to pick up the tab. I think we're just in an era, in a generation now, where it's important to, you know, make sure that you're doing as much as you possibly can within reason to have a comfortable or moderate retirement.
And I would just say, to add to what you said there, Lee, for the 5-odd million freelancers, self-employed people, it really is on you. You can't rely on your employer. So when you think about how much you charge clients, etc., you think about a certain amount for tax, certain amount for your pension as well. I know it's difficult. I'm a freelancer. But as Lee says, you have to prioritize yourself, because there really isn't anyone else who's going to do it if you're a freelancer. Right, reader question time. We love a good neighbourly dispute. So we've got another one. Last month, my wife and I decided to replace the fences, it's always fences, isn't it, on either side of our garden to make it more private. The original fences were only 4 foot high, and the children of one family were always bouncing on a trampoline, which, you know, as you can imagine, feels even more intrusive. We asked both our neighbours if they were interested in contributing towards a bigger fence, but both said they weren't bothered. We mentioned that we might go ahead with it anyway, and they seemed pretty relaxed about it. So they decided to, well, double the size of their existing fence to 8 feet fence panels. Now, one of our neighbours is complaining that not only have we removed their fence, which apparently we had no right to do, but that our new fence is so high that we should have got planning permission. They said if we don't reinstall the old fence, they're going to report us to the council. What should we do? Now, this goes back. We had a story about this once, didn't we? Well, we've had a few stories about fences. Something about the right-hand side, something about the left-hand side. Apparently, it's not true. Break it all down. What's going on?
I'm on the fence for this one, Georgie, I think.
Boom, leech.
Okay. Any sort of rule that you've heard about, it's always the fence on the left-hand side that's yours or something like that. Ignore it. It's total nonsense for a start. Whose fence is whose should be stated in your property deeds. It will either state it in there, i.e. this is your fence and you have to maintain it, or more likely there might be something called T-marks. And the way the T-marks are is that the base of the T points towards your fence. Now, that'll tell you whose fence it is. Unfortunately, many people will go and look at their property deeds and discover that there's none of these things and nobody knows. So then effectively it's a shared fence. But don't, you know, any of this nonsense around kind of like, oh, well, the person who put it up, it belongs to and so on, so they have to pay to maintain it. That none of that stuff's necessarily true, okay? Even if there are no T marks. If you put the fence up, it is your property, however. And so if your neighbour damages your property, then you can go back to them. But in terms of the height, any fence that is more than 2 meters, you do need to have planning permission for.
What's 2 meters in feet?
6.5 foot. So that is not actually that high, right? So basically, Standard fence is 6 foot, and then quite often you'll have maybe a kind of something underneath it that raises it up a little bit, and that will hit your 6.5 foot, right? But if you think about it, all it takes is a really tall person in the garden next door, and they can see over the fence, which actually, you know, most people are not 6.5 foot tall or taller, but some people are. But what you've also got to remember is also most people's gardens aren't necessarily completely level with their neighbours. So if your neighbour's garden is higher than yours and your fence between the two of you is 6 foot, then they might be able to see over the top. Or maybe they might be bouncing on a trampoline. Or maybe it might help you with the privacy from somebody looking out of the window and so on. But as I said, the general rule, unless you live in a conservation area or a listed building, is that a fence can be a maximum height of 1 meter if it faces a road. That's interesting. Most people don't know that. Or 2 meters otherwise. Therefore, an 8 foot fence requires planning permission. Now, the answer to the question of these people is to comply with the law. You should install panels no taller than 2 meters. If you didn't do this, the local authority, but probably not your neighbour, has the power to enforce planning law. Your neighbours could report you to the council for breaching planning permission. The council could come round and say, you need to lower that fence or take it down. It's quite an extreme point to get to, really. The difficulty is it's not as easy as just cutting 2 foot off the top of your fence, which has been suggested by some of our readers in the comments. So you can't just like take a circular saw to the top of your fence or something like that. But, you know, these kind of neighbourly disputes are the things that lead to those stories that you read where somebody has spent tens of thousands of pounds arguing with their neighbour about it. The unfortunate thing here is something that I suspect happens quite a lot, is these people have approached their neighbours ahead of it and gone, we're going to replace the fence. It wasn't even their fence necessarily to replace. They've done the good thing. They've paid for the fence. They've said, look, it's bothering us. We know it's not bothering you, but we'll pay for it. And the neighbours said, meh, okay, whatever. And then they've done it. And then the neighbour's gone, ah, we're not happy with that. You need to take that down. They will have spent thousands of pounds putting up a fence. So obviously we're in a scenario where what you need to do is between the two of you, you need to come to an agreement. Now, the difficulty with that is, are they going to sit down around a table and have that conversation? We've talked about this before, haven't we? Or are they going to be sending text messages that could be misconstrued, emails that get increasingly snotty? I'll tell you what I'd do. I'd find an independent person, not an independent fence arbitration specialist, although maybe those people exist, but maybe just another neighbour, one that isn't, you know, adjoining to the property. Yeah, just somebody that you both get on with in the road, sit down round the table, have a cup of tea, you know, I was going to say have a glass of wine, but, you know, don't do that. You might up the argument ante, mightn't it, you know. Get stuck into the beers and then have a chat about it. But anyway, you don't want to let this thing, you know, go down the route of the disputes. But the thing is also, do you have any rights of privacy? There is no absolute law which provides privacy for a garden. If your neighbours are doing something that's causing a nuisance, then you might be able to report them for causing a nuisance. Don't do it in retaliation over the fence. The best thing to do is try and sort it out between you. There is a property litigation association, and RICS have launched a new mediation service to help neighbours resolve disputes over their property boundaries without resorting to court action, the Boundary Disputes Mediation Service. But maybe you can sort it out before you get there or without taking legal advice. And finally, for people in this position, consider a hedge. If your neighbour says no to the fence, consider a hedge. Now, you're not allowed to just plant any old hedge. There is something that's referred to as the High Hedges Act, which was to stop people growing unbelievably high Leylandii hedges that were massively impacting their neighbours. But if that refers to evergreen or semi-evergreen trees or shrubs over 2 metres. But if you plant a hedge of native deciduous planting, that will not fall foul of the legislation. And it's also a good habitat for wildlife and things like that. So, you know, planting is a good idea. And to go back to, I think, the last time we talked about something like this on the podcast, this is why people should be really careful about moving in places. And you might look at your garden and think, oh, it's a bit overgrown. But don't be a chainsaw Charlie who goes out there and cuts down all of the established planting, because that stuff takes decades to grow. And you might have a neighbour who's suddenly quite upset about it.
Quite indeed. Lee, for the sake of just like a foot and a half, talking about threatening to go to the council.
A foot and a half is quite a lot, Georgie. The difference between a 6 foot fence and an 8 foot fence is actually quite a lot. Height is huge. You know, I would say that typically 5 or 6 foot fence is what we're used to in this country. And actually, I have been doing a bit of house hunting recently, and I stepped out into the garden of a place recently. And although it didn't have an 8 foot fence, it had a probably 2 to 3 foot wall. And then it had a 5 or 6 foot fence on top of it. And it actually felt really quite like, for privacy, I kind of get it, but it also felt quite ridiculously high. And actually 8 foot fence is quite ridiculously high, if you ask me. I think that's going a little bit too far. And rightly so, there should be planning permission put in place for things like this, because it's probably unnecessary. Yeah, okay, your next door neighbor might be a basketball player and maybe they can peer over. But on the whole, I find it an 8 foot fence is probably quite over the top. And I would say it's probably quite a niche sized fence. If you're living next door to Shaq, you know, if he's moving over from America and Shaq O'Neal, you know, giant basketball player, you know, but even then, I think I'd quite like him peering over the fence saying hello because he's a nice guy. But like, you know, I just can't imagine a sort of scenario in which 8 foot fence really makes sense.
Right, Simon's stat of the week.
Can I just say, ahead of my stat of the week, the one thing that I would advise you not to do is to get around this problem by planting bamboo. You know, that is incredibly invasive, causes massive amounts of damage. And that is the way round that lots of people have got around this problem, is by planting bamboo. Google that before you plant any bamboo and you'll understand why you shouldn't do it. Right. My stat of the week is not actually a stat of the week this week. My stat of the week is a warning of the week. We've had lots of stories about AI scams, videos, social media, and things like that. There is one at the moment that is, I don't know whether it's an investment scam, right? But I definitely don't trust it, and I wouldn't trust where this ends up, right? This is not the place you want to be taking your investment advice from. And it involves videos popping up on Instagram of people that you may recognize. So far this week, I've had Stephanie Flanders, Gary Stevenson, and Peter Hargreaves. And the Peter Hargreaves one is, hi, I'm Peter Hargreaves. I'm back at Hargreaves Lansdown, and I've created a WhatsApp group. It's a space for investors. Each day I share 3 hand-picked stock ideas, and so on and so on. And then if you read the text below, you know, in 2025, I returned to the board to help restore clarity and disciplines of long-term investing, philosophy I've held since founding HL in 1981. But not only is Peter Hargreaves apparently doing that, he's set up a WhatsApp investment group, and every day he'll screen the most explosive stocks in the market, build portfolios covering different risk preferences, and immediately issue warnings and analysis when key turning points appear. Then goes on to talk about, for example, a stock I shared in the group last month rose 45%, which means that if you bought at $500,000, you would have $725,000 a month later. Because why wouldn't you put $500,000 into a share of something that you'd seen a video on the internet on? Anyway, it doesn't take a genius to work out that that's not actually Peter Hargreaves. This is a scam. Do not go through with it. So if you see a video and they look really convincing, first time I saw it, I was like, is this some kind of new marketing thing that HL are doing? It's not, okay? It's not Peter Hargreaves. It's not Stephanie Flanders. It's not Gary Stevenson. It's not any one of those famous financial people popping up in your Instagram feed to tell you about stock tips. It's a scam. Don't fall for it.
We shall leave it there, Simon. Thank you very much for your warning of the week. That is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk and come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments. And do not forget to come to the website and read the comments on the sheds. Do not forget to come to the website and read the comments on the fence story.
Exactly. And if you like this podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.